Welcome to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we'll get some answers, some of the most compelling questions we get at reasonablefaith.org. But before we begin, I'd like to remind you that Reasonable Faith chapters are springing up all over the United States and in countries throughout the world. Now, this is an exciting development at Reasonable Faith, and we have a special guest we'd like to introduce to talk more about it. Dr. Craig, do the honors.
I certainly will. Chris Shannon is our National Director for Reasonable Faith Local Chapters. Chris is the founder of the Dallas, Texas Local Chapter, which is really the flagship, I think, of our local Reasonable Faith chapters, which we hope will spring up on college campuses and in churches all around the country and internationally as well. And so Chris is here with us today to tell us a little bit about these local chapters.
Chris, tell us all about it.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this time together, and I really am so excited to be a part of the Reasonable Faith Ministry. It's such a vital ministry in the Christian community, and we're very excited about this new phase of the ministry where we're going to be bringing together like-minded believers for dialogue about difficult issues regarding our faith and also about how to be more competent in defending our faith, and also as an outreach to non-believers. And there's a considerable degree of autonomy that's allowed with each chapter. The key here is to have a director of a chapter who's very passionate, who's very serious and devoted, and they have a lot of autonomy to develop the programs and the things that they do for the interest of those that are involved. And so that's going to look like having book discussion groups, watching DVDs of debates and lectures of Dr. Craig's, working through Dr. Craig's Reasonable Faith third edition book and going through the study guide, and also inviting in guest speakers or whatever else works for the interests of the particular chapter.
The discussions are just so much fun and enlightening when you get together. You have a real passion for this as well. You like to see these, of course, all over the world. Tell us about that passion.
Absolutely. Well, we've seen in the research that's come out over the past quite a few years that Christians are ill-equipped, not only in understanding their faith at a very deep level, but also in being able to defend their faith. And so we're looking for ways to equip the church, the Christian community, to make a difference in these areas where a difference really needs to be made. And so we have a tremendous passion to start these chapters, not just nationally, but internationally, where like-minded believers can come together and gain this equipping. And so we think this is going to have a tremendous impact, and we're very excited to what it's going to do, not only within the Christian community, but also within an outreach to non-believers who have a lot of questions today about Christianity, and we need to have good answers to their questions.
Absolutely. And I'm sure there's a multitude of people listening right now who would like to start a Reasonable Faith chapter in their area. How would one go about doing that?
The best way to do that is to go to the Reasonable Faith website, so reasonablefaith.org, and all the information is on the website. You can click on the icon in the upper right of the homes page that says chapters, and then you'll be taken to a page where the process is that you go through to start a chapter. So it's a pretty simple and streamlined process that you go through. There's quite a few people going through it right now. We've received a tremendous response from people about this, so we're very excited. And as I said, both nationally and internationally, we're receiving chapters that are start. We're receiving applications for chapters to start all over the world. And so the what you would need to do is to first fill out an application online. And then second, provide us with your spiritual narrative, which will detail how you became a Christian and what your walk is like today with Christ. And then you would go through the Reasonable Faith third edition book and fill out the study guide questions, provide answers to the study guide questions that go along with that book. And once you've done that, then you'll be a director and can start your own chapter.
Now, Chris, you're going to guide folks as they go through this study guide. Isn't that correct, to see that the answers are right?
Exactly. We want to make sure that people understand Dr. Craig's work and that they're competent with it, and we want to make sure that they provide us with detailed and thorough answers to the questions, and so that we really know that the director of the chapter is highly motivated and they're knowledgeable and they're very serious. And so they're going to be sending me the answers to the questions of the study guide, and then I'm going to be dialoguing with them if there's any answers that they need to to change, and we'll go through that process as many iterations as we need to until satisfactory, and then we can move on from there to start their chapter.
Now, you went through that process, Chris, with me. How did you find it? Was that a good experience for you?
Yes, I thought it was a great experience. It was extremely helpful to me. I think it's a fantastic thing that there's a study guide to go along with this book. This book has so much rich information in it. It's such an important book for Christian apologetics, and so many times you read a book and then you don't retain a lot of the information in it, and it helps to put the information, the concepts that you're learning into your own words, into a study guide type of situation. And so I think that's going to be really beneficial for people to learn.
Where's that first meeting going to be, Chris, and who's going to be speaking at it?
The first meeting is going to be at Park City's Baptist Church. In the Ellis Parlor Room, and we'll be meeting there regularly. It's located at Dallas Parkway and Northwest Highway. And our first meeting, we're going to be flying in Greg Kokel, the founder and president of Stand to Reason Ministries, and he's going to be speaking on Is One Way the Only Way? So we'll be dealing with the issue of religious pluralism.
Chris Shannon, thank you so much for your work and the good job you're doing here in Dallas, the local chapter of the Reasonable Faith chapter. And we want to talk to you again about this. This could get dangerous. This could start actually equipping people. People know why they believe what they believe, and revival might break out.
Right. Absolutely. We're hoping so, and we really appreciate your help. And we're really excited about this and look forward to seeing how the Lord uses it.
Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's turn now to some questions that we get at reasonablefaith.org, Dr. Craig. We take time during these podcasts to answer some questions that we get. Dear Dr. Craig, my question basically is in regard to the mind of God and His creation. That is, why did God create us? What is the meaning and purpose of life? Why am I here? And what does God want me to do with my life? In other words, why did God create me? And this gentleman who's asking this is 17 years old, and he's a Christian. He's seeking God, and he says your work has really helped him in his relationship with God and so on. But here's a 17-year-old young man who's asking about some age-old questions of the meaning and purpose of life and why God created us.
Well, these are the most fundamental questions that a person can ask. I remember as a 16-year-old, before I came to know Christ in a personal way, I was deeply troubled by the question of the meaning of my existence and why I was here. And I think that the answer to that question from a Christian point of view is beautifully expressed in the Westminster Catechism when it asks, what is the chief end of man? And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. The purpose of our existence is to know God. And in being in personal relationship to God, the ultimate source of infinite goodness and love, we find the fulfillment of human existence. It is what we were made for. Only an infinite good could satisfy our deepest longings for infinity, forever. Any finite good, no matter how wonderful, after enough time would become boring and cloying and even annoying. Only an infinite good could satisfy our deepest longings forever, and that's what God is. So God has created us to know Him and to be in relationship to Him, to enjoy Him forever. Now, what's interesting about that is that it means that God didn't create us out of any need in Himself. It wasn't as though God was lonely without creation and needed company, and so created us. God, in the tri-unity of His own being, is an eternal fellowship of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, an eternal fellowship of love and knowledge and will. And the wonder of creation is that God would make finite persons in His image and invite them into this intra-Trinitarian relationship, not for His benefit, but rather for the benefit of those finite persons themselves. So God created us for our good, that we could have the wonderful good of knowing Him, the infinite source of goodness and love, not out of any need or want on His own part.
I'm glad you're saying that, because I wish I had a nickel for every time someone said that God must have been really lonely out there and He created us for companionship and for fellowship with us and things, which is only half right. I mean, God doesn't lack anything. He's complete. And so He creates us, are you saying, out of His desire He's free to have that desire, but it's not a need.
Right.
It's just more of an expression of who he is.
That's right. It's an expression of God's love, his self-giving love, that he would create finite creatures so that they might have the wonder and joy of this intra-Trinitarian fellowship that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have enjoyed from eternity. We become adopted sons and daughters of God who are in relationship with the persons of the Trinity. So that when you think about it, Kevin, creation, just as much as salvation, is by grace alone. It is an act of God's grace, his unmerited self-giving favor, that he would bestow this grace upon us to be able to know him.
Well, life has purpose and meaning because of God, because of Christ. That's good news.
Yes, exactly. Now, this would be the general purpose and meaning of human existence. But in addition to that, there's also going to be a specific purpose for your life, the reason for which you exist. And God will have a vocation or a calling for you to fulfill in life. And part of the wonder of walking with Christ is finding that vocation for which he has called you and finding fulfillment in carrying out the work that he's given you to do during the years that he's given you on this planet.
Let's go to another question then from someone much older than 17. Dr. Craig, I was once a born-again evangelical Christian, but now I am a secular humanist, even though I still believe in God. Basically, I am a deist. Now, a deist, clear that up for someone who may not be familiar
with
the
term. Well, he's already, in a sense, said some things that are self-contradictory. If he's a deist, that means he believes that there is a God who has created and designed the universe, a personal, transcendent creator. And therefore, he's not a secular humanist. A secular humanist doesn't believe in God. And so this person is not a secular humanist. He's, in fact, a theist of sorts. He believes that there is a designer and creator of the universe who has made us, but he doesn't think that this God has revealed himself in any particular religion. He's not the Christian God. He's not the Muslim God. He's not a Hindu God. He's a sort of God of nature, as it were, the creator and designer of the world, but not the God of any specific religion. That's very different from secular humanism.
He goes on to say, I think that some of your arguments for God are quite strong, but I think that your defense of Christianity as a religion is rather weak, and I mean this not as an insult. I just don't think it can be effectively defended. I'd like to tell you why and see what your response is. Now, I'll give you the kernel of what he says. He says, first of all, I really do not see how you can claim the divinity of Jesus when so much of what he said was not true. He says, it seems that a reasonable litmus test of his divinity would be to examine the things he says and examine whether they are false, as a divine being would obviously not make mistakes. I have read Dave Allison's book, Jesus of Nazareth, Millenarian Prophet. The book, as you know, is something of an updated version of Albert Schweitzer's Quest for the Historical Jesus. Now, both of these books, Dr. Craig, I'm sure you're familiar with Dave Allison's book, as well as Albert Schweitzer's, both liberal views of the historical Jesus.
Right. What Allison and Schweitzer both thought was that Jesus was an apocalyptic preacher who believed that the end of the world and the kingdom of God was going to come either during his lifetime or at least the lifetime of his hearers, and that this did not eventuate. And this is a serious problem for followers of Christ. It's often called the delay of the parousia. The parousia is the Greek term for the second coming of Christ. And the question is, why is the second coming of Christ delayed? Why has it not happened? Did this mean that Jesus of Nazareth was mistaken in thinking that the parousia or the second coming would occur within the lifetimes of those who heard and followed him?
And that is this questioner's dilemma.
Yes, it is.
It apparently led him, according to him, away from the Christian faith because Jesus was wrong about the end of the world.
Right.
It did not occur during the lifetime of the disciples or his own lifetime, so on.
Right. That seems to be the difficulty. Now, one thing to notice, Kevin, is that we need to put this in context. Very often I find with objectors that an objection or a doubt that they have looms so large that it gets completely out of proportion with everything else. It's like holding your thumb up close to your eye so that your thumb looks bigger than a skyscraper that you see on the horizon. And very often I find doubters allow their doubts to get all out of proportion with the context. He said the case for Christianity is weak, and yet he said nothing about the evidence for Jesus' radical personal claims, and especially the evidence for his resurrection. If we're persuaded that the evidence for Jesus' resurrection is very powerful and convincing, then we have good grounds for believing that Jesus was, in fact, who he claimed to be. And that will then provide a context in which we'll look at these claims about the second coming and ask ourselves, well, what in the world was going on here? What did he mean by these claims? And we'll attempt to interpret them in a way that makes sense of them. But they will be taken in the context of a very convincing case for the divinity of Jesus provided by his miracles, his radical personal claims, and his resurrection. So I think it's important, before we address his specific question, to set the evidential context, lest this objection appear to be the only thing that needs to be taken into consideration in considering the identity of Jesus.
So what would you think then? Is there a possibility, even if Christ rose again and backed up his claims and so on, and he was vindicated by God, that he could have been wrong about the end of the world?
Well, some New Testament scholars have suggested this. Robert Gundry, for example, has said that this is possible in light of the incarnation, that Christ's humanity was so dominant that he was mistaken about the date of the parousia. But I don't think we need to go that far, Kevin. When you look at the statements of Jesus about his return, what you notice is that he says no one knows the date of his return. He says, I don't know the date of my return. It could be any time. And he gives certain parables that suggest that it will be a long time before his return. For example, the parable of the bridegroom who is delayed in coming to the wedding and returns only later at midnight after everyone has retired and gone to bed. And he talks about those who were asleep when the bridegroom finally arrived. Or he talks about the man who goes into a far country and gives his estate to be managed by his servants. And it takes him a long time before he returns. And one of the slaves, while his master is delayed, says, my master is delayed in his coming. And he begins to beat the other servants and treat them disrespectfully. There are a number of parables like this that Jesus gives that suggest a long delay before his return and need to be set alongside of those few passages in which you have expressions of Jesus that, taken in and of themselves in isolation, might suggest that he expected his return within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. So again, there's evidence on both sides. Now, what about those passages where Jesus seems to speak as though his return might occur within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses? I think that it's probably the case that when you read these sayings in their original settings, that they were not intended to indicate that Jesus would return within the lifetime of those who were hearing him. And I say that on the basis of a passage in Matthew chapter 10, where Jesus gives the charge to the 12 disciples to go on a mission preaching throughout the towns of Israel. And this passage actually sharpens the problem for us. It makes it more acute, and by doing so, I think, gives us good grounds for thinking that these sayings in their original context didn't have the implications that they might appear to in the context in which we find them today. In Matthew 10, it says he sends the disciples out to the cities of Israel to preach and cast out unclean spirits and heal people of every disease. And he says, do not go into the way of the Gentiles, do not enter a city of the Samaritans, go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So this is a tour of preaching that is only going to be through the cities of Israel. And he describes what will happen, how the disciples will be persecuted and encounter opposition and so forth. And then in verse 23, we find this astounding statement. When they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. So here, it sounds as though the second coming of Christ, the return of the Son of Man, is going to occur before the disciples even complete their preaching tour of the towns of Israel. And yet we know that didn't happen. Matthew goes on, or Luke goes on, to talk about how they returned from this preaching tour, and Jesus continues to work with his disciples. What this suggests to me is that in the original context in which these sayings were given, they didn't have the implication that they appear to have to us today who read them in a quite different context. In the original context, these things did not mean that Jesus was going to return during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses any more than this saying in Matthew 10:23 meant that the parousia was going to occur before the disciples had gone through all of the towns of Israel on their teaching tour. So we need to remember what kind of literature the Gospels are. The Gospels are compilations of the sayings of Jesus, and very often these sayings will appear in different literary contexts today than they did in the original context in which they were given. And I think we have good grounds for thinking, based on his parables about the long delay, based upon his sayings that no one knows the time of his return, that in their original context, these sayings were not meant to imply that the parousia would take place within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. It might, but not necessarily. Every generation needs to be prepared to be the last.
Thank you so much for listening to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig, and we'll pick it up there next time and answer some more questions that we receive at reasonablefaith.org. One more time, if you would like to start a Reasonable Faith chapter in your area, information is at reasonablefaith.org. And by the way, if you appreciate the information that you get at reasonablefaith.org and you would like to see these podcasts continue and see us branch out even further, then be a partner with us. You can find out how when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Your financial and prayer support means a great deal to us. That's reasonablefaith.org, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.